You're listening to Greater LA, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Fire in Sonoma County. Fire near the Getty in the western Sepulveda Pass. Fire surrounding the Reagan Library in Simi Valley. We've been reporting and hearing about fires for weeks now. But only a year has passed, 1 year exactly tomorrow, since the Woolsey Fire began. It's a fire that burnt through a huge area from Thousand Oaks all across the Santa Monica Mountains to Malibu. In the path of that blaze was the community of Malibu Lake. Today, this town is back to being a beautiful and peaceful place. About 250 residents live in the hills that surround the reservoir. Mai Lindquist is one of them. She's 53 years old. She's been living lakeside almost her entire life in a cabin that was built way back in 1924. Well, she lived in that cabin till this time last year, when it was one of the 1,500 buildings destroyed by the Woolsey Fire.
Finally back on my own property in a trailer, a small 26-foot-long trailer. It's nice to be on my property. It's kind of comforting in a weird way.
L.A. County helped Mai to remove the ash and debris from her property, but her trailer still sits among the rubble and coal-black trees and unrecognizable junk, pieces left of what used to be her home. She says she'll rebuild. She says she doesn't want to live anywhere else.
It's just where I'm used to seeing the sun come up, you know? I mean, you do that for 40 years and you're used to it.
1 year after the Woolsey Fire, some homeowners with good insurance and lots of resources are picking up the pieces, and they're rebuilding large, beautiful homes. Mai Lindquist is not one of them. Reporter Kirsten Zilm visited her in the used RV where she and her two dachshunds live, and she brings us Mai's story.
My aluminum ladder. There's a guy coming from LA, actually.
Mai is frustrated. Her long brown hair is up in a careless bun. She is a wiry woman in jeans cleaning up her ruined property. Everything in the process of rebuilding involves uncertainty and lots of paperwork, with the Federal Emergency Agency FEMA, with county and city administrations. Right now, it is the septic tank.
What I was going to do was I was just going to go and do like a small channel.
If it does not pass inspection tomorrow, Mai cannot keep her trailer on the property. Next is the power pole. She has to get her own source for electricity.
And they gave me a month. I can't get a temporary power pole in a month for the time it takes for the SCE guy to come out and then to get someone to drop a power pole and then to get the actual parts and stuff and get an electrician out and then have it signed off by building and safety is not going to happen in 30 freaking days.
Mai is far from recovery. It's not just logistics. She also is emotionally overwhelmed. And now neighbors, friends, and even her doctor tell Mai that it's time to get her act together and move on.
People are becoming not only apathetic, but to the point where they're like cynical or, you know, downright, like, you know, those of us that lost our entire life, you know, everything but a laundry basket of stuff, you know, that were just a bunch of whiners.
Life today, Mai says, sometimes feels worse than it did that night a year ago when flames closed in on Malibu Lake.
I'm going to update you on this breaking news. If you're just waking up, there are two major fires raging right now.
That night of November 8th, Mai stayed close to her cabin even after mandatory evacuation orders were issued for the area. Power and cell phone reception soon were down.
This is what the scene looks like, a completely hellish landscape all throughout this little valley here in this ridge.
Only when the smoke became too thick to breathe and embers flew over her head, Mai grabbed her two dogs, a few heirlooms, books and drawings, jumped into her car and drove to safety.
I left one eagle feather that friends gave to me at the eclipse last year up in Idaho, and I left that outside with the house. And I put my hand on the house and I said, "House, you got to do it for me." And said,
told the ghost. There's a ghost in my house. I told her, you gotta take care of the house for me. I can't do it.
When Mai came back, all that was left of her home was smoldering rubble. She had no insurance. 30 houses burned down at the lake. The first weeks, Mai says, neighbors helped each other out with food, generators, and tools.
It was a special time for neighbors and for everyone. I mean, it was everyone was bonding, everyone was pulling together, everyone was caring.
Lots of local people still help fire survivors. Volunteers fill out paperwork, make phone calls, donate clothes, furniture, and food. On Tuesdays, a church in Westlake Village hosts the Fresh Market with donated vegetables, milk, meat, bread, and cookies. Flowers sit in buckets at the exit. Mai Lindquist comes here every week. She jokes with almost everyone in line. An hour later, she pulls a cart filled with food and two bouquets of red daisies back to her car.
The flowers are always a score for me. The other score probably is the cottage cheese. And I found gluten-free raisin bread.
Mai depends on food from the church. Before the fire, she worked as a handywoman in construction. She had just remodeled her basement with the intention to rent it out. Now, Mai makes money helping neighbors and friends fix their dryers, lights, and leaking faucets. She has trouble focusing on a job search. Money is very tight.
I'm living off my FEMA money. I don't go anywhere. I don't do anything. I don't eat out. I don't go out. I buy, you know, the bare necessities. I'm pinching and wringing out every damn penny, you know.
This tough, no-nonsense woman who'd rather crack a joke or curse than admit that she needs help says sometimes she calls Michelle Wright, a volunteer caseworker at the church, and asks for prayers. Like she did after discovering a fracture in her septic tank the day before inspection.
We were on the phone and she said, hey, could you say a little prayer for my septic tank? And I said, let's do it right now, Mai. And so we prayed together. And the next day she came, she's like, Michelle, that prayer worked. That septic tank passed inspection.
When times get really rough, Mai turns on music in her trailer, sits outside in the sun, and pictures the home she wants to build, a little bigger than the old one, with lots of light and solar panels. There are days, though, Mai says, when everything just seems too much.
I certainly want to curl up in a ball and not do any of it, you know, but that's not really an option. You keep walking in the direction that your toes are pointed, right?
Now that it's fire season once again in Southern California, Mai is on high alert. She is prepared to leave should flames come close, but not ready to give up on rebuilding her home on this beautiful spot she has known for more than 40 years. For KCRW, I'm Kerstin Zilm.
Well, it seems like wildfires have gotten worse and more frequent in recent times, as evidenced by the Woolsey Fire or the Thomas Fire before that, or the Camp Wildfire that we saw decimate an entire town last year in Northern California. There's no doubt those fires would be cataclysmic were it not for the hard work and bravery of a few thousand men and women all up and down California. At its peak, there were more than 1,100 firefighters on the ground fighting last week's Getty Fire here in L.A., and the Kincade Fire up in Northern California, more than 3,000 firefighters. The Maria Fire along the Central Coast, more than 600. Firefighters learn and train, and they upend their lives when a blaze breaks out in hopes of putting it out. It can be incredibly taxing, both physically and mentally, for the folks who are on the front line. So what is it like being there when hell on earth is literally staring you in the face? City of L.A. Fire Department Captain Miguel Meza knows that perspective all too well, and he's with us right now. Captain Meza, thank you for your time, and thanks for your service.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Were you among the hundreds battling the recent Getty fire?
You know, I served as part of the incident management team overlooking the needs of the incident as well as the needs in the city at the time. Got a chance to serve for over 84 hours at the Getty fire and about 82 hours or so at the Palisades fire the week before.
It's hard to imagine walking toward a fire when everybody's running away from it. You risk a lot. You risk everything for that matter. You fight the fire. Talk us through what it's like going there.
Well, as firefighters for the Los Angeles Fire Department, training and safety are paramount for us from day one of joining the department. Our motto is train as if your life depends on it, because it does. It gives us the opportunity to, in the heat of the moment, do what we're trained to do.
What's going through your head, though?
My focus is to know what my job is per our standard operating guidelines, execute that to the best of my ability, report back to see what else needs to be done. What's on my mind is that there are people, experiencing their worst day of their life. And we're there in an opportunity to not only make their lives better, but even save their lives if needed.
It's hard for me to imagine in this sort of a job, when you have a family at home and you're, 4 days on or 6 days on, sometimes 8 days on, fighting a wildfire. So how do you navigate something like that and keep some semblance of a normal life when actually you're also married to your job?
That's a great question. When we pick up our hands and take that oath to protect the citizens of Los Angeles, that commitment is made by our families as well. You mentioned in reference that we're gone 3, 4, 5 days at a time, all kinds of holidays. We need to have a really strong family support system to not only make sure that they can take care of things while we're gone, but they can also be understanding of what our schedules looks like. I give so much credit to my wife alone, because she is just an amazing person that does so many tasks when I'm not available. She's resilient, and you'll find a lot of firefighting families to be very resilient.
You guys put on a lot of gear, just pounds and pounds added on top of you. And you're going in there trying to battle a blaze. So it's blazing hot, probably, inside that uniform.
Yeah, that's a really great point. Our turnout equipment provides three layers of protection. And the goal of protection is to make sure that no heat gets inside of our personal area, our skin. But also, just like a stove, it's designed not to let any heat out. It's really incumbent of all of our firefighters to be physically fit and conditioned and making sure that we're able to meet the challenges. A lot of the incidents that we go on, they're bursts of energy. They're not things that we do for a long period of time. They're bursts of energy. So we train and we prepare physically for those same types of simulations. I'm happy to report that my mindset has always been, it's really important for me to make sure that I can not only put on my 60 plus pounds of equipment, not only have additional equipment I'm going to carry with me, but also to be ready to pick somebody up out of a fire, carry them out, whether it be a citizen or one of my coworkers.
60 pounds of equipment.
At the minimum.
Yes.
Between a turnout coat with all kinds of tools and equipment, turnout pants, heavy Kevlar turnout boots that have all kinds of plating around them. You got your helmet and you have your breathing apparatus. It's over 20 pounds itself. Yeah, easily we could be in 60 plus pounds of equipment.
You've been doing this for a long time. You said a couple decades now. I can imagine that there are some incidents that probably stay with you a lot longer than others, right?
Yes, there's one that it made recent news. There was a incident back in April 9th of 2015 where a man drove his family into the port of Los Angeles. Mm. That was an incident that I responded to. Because of the situation with two kids submerged in a vehicle 30 feet below the water and having kids of myself, that really just led me to do everything I could on the incident. Yeah, I ended up actually kicking my shoes, my boots off, taking my coat off. And after I just directed the people on the surface, the parents, to make their way up the ladder, I started diving down to the vehicle with a hope and a prayer of finding a leg and an arm I could bring up to the surface.
The trauma of something like that, what happened to those kids, by the way?
Unfortunately, they ended up passing away. One passed away the day of and one passed away the next day. It's been really hard for me to kind of heal from that. I have a lot of guilt, the fact that they didn't make it, and I have a lot of just a lot of emotions that come with it. It's been a timely thing, but I'm happy to report that our department really has looked at behavioral health. The Los Angeles Fire Department, unfortunately, has been a victim of behavioral health. We've had over 9 suicides in the last 3 years. Mm. Our department has been very proactive in addressing this face head on with 2 department psychologists and a licensed marriage family therapist that is available to us. And now the culture has been shifting. We have what we call peer support members. They're sworn members that have been trained in a 40-hour class to understand what exactly it means about behavioral health, what it means, you know, to what our role is in that, and how important it is to develop skills so that we can be a support system to firefighters. You know, it's really hard for anybody of this career line to talk to someone of a medical professional sometimes, whether it be pride or whether it be other issues. We find it easier to speak to other firefighters about issues because we've been there. We know what it's like. So the peer support system is an awesome opportunity for one firefighter to talk to another firefighter, connect with them, and hopefully tell them that they're not alone, that what they've gone through in traumatic event and the emotions that they're going to experience are there to be expected, and to provide healthy means for addressing and coping with those issues.
Hopefully those words have been said to you as well.
Absolutely. You know, I as I mentioned before, this there was a trial that just ended last week with a gentleman, and I had to testify in court for that.
It
brought back a lot of scars and a lot of memories that I've kind of put to bed. But over the period of a 20 to 30 year career, these are things that are cumulative. They happen to us, you know, from a drowning of a child to, you know, all kinds of incidents that we see along the lines. We're scarred. And the more people could understand that first responders are, we're human too, and we're not robots. We have feelings, and we need to make sure that the culture now is to address those feelings so we can have a healthy lifestyle. So many people are depending on us, from the citizens of LA to the people we work with to our own family members.
Captain Miguel Meza, part of the LA City Fire Department, I want to thank you for your hard work that you've done to protect people and communities all across LA, and thank you for sharing your experience with us.
Thank you.
Well, for trying to save those kids and jumping into the harbor to get to them, Captain Meza received the Medal of Valor from the LA City Fire Department. Coming up on this program, Weed Maps. The Yelp of cannabis shops is coming down from a high. It's Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward with KCRW's Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Earlier this week, authorities confiscated $1.5 billion worth of illegal cannabis in California. Now, recreational marijuana has been legal here for nearly 2 years. It hasn't seemed, though, to curb the unlicensed market. In fact, the illegal weed market is thriving. A lot of folks are still going out and buying unlicensed pot. It's often cheaper than its legal counterpart, which is heavily taxed. And just like anything else these days, people buy what they trust and from whom they know. One company, which operates kind of like the Yelp of weed, is a clearinghouse for cannabis shops, and it helps users find and rate and review dispensaries. That platform, called Weed Maps, it's based in Irvine, is also under pressure from California regulators to only list legal suppliers. It recently laid off a quarter of its staff, and here to talk us through what that means for the cannabis market is Abdullah Saeed. He's a cannabis media maker and host of the podcast Great Moments in Weed History. Welcome, Abdullah.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve.
Is this a great moment in weed history right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, this absolutely is. Me getting to be on KCRW? Absolutely.
I'm curious about the fact that the company back in August announced that they were going to ban advertisements from unlicensed retailers. They've been operating for the past, gosh, 10, 12 years. Mm-hmm. So why now? Why are they just now doing this?
Essentially, Gavin Newsom in July actually signed a new law that creates penalties of up to as much as $30,000 per day for continuing to list unlicensed dispensaries.
Per day. Yeah. Wow. There was the news a few weeks ago, Abdullah, that Weedmaps would be laying off 100 people. This is about a quarter of their staff, mm-hmm. including staff members from their headquarters in Irvine. I know you reached out to Weedmaps for this story.
Yes.
What did they have to say about the reason for the layoffs?
So Weedmaps essentially says that they're trying their best to be compliant with state law and not list unlicensed dispensaries. Essentially, Weedmaps is making less money because they're unable to list as many dispensaries, and that directly affects their bottom line. So they're not able to keep as many employees staffed.
You reached out to the Bureau of Cannabis Control. Do they have an alternate method for steering someone to legal dispensaries or legal marijuana in general?
They do. They've launched their own campaign, the hashtag WeedWise campaign, and also a website called CA Pot Check, through which you can search for a dispensary and see if they're actually licensed. I'm not exactly sure how well it's doing. I'm a pretty regular cannabis consumer, and I had never heard of it until I reached out to the BCC for a statement. So I'm not sure if it's something.
Did you check it out?
I did check it out. It's a little bit unwieldy. It sort of feels like your typical government website. The thing is that people have actually heard of Weedmaps. Cannabis consumers have known about Weedmaps for about a decade, and it's taken them a while to become so ubiquitous. So it's going to be really difficult for the state to introduce a website or a hashtag campaign that's going to catch on and fill the shoes of Weedmaps.
Pretty big shoes to fill, right?
Very big.
Yeah. How does this all factor in, Abdullah, to when it comes to access to marijuana? When people want access to marijuana, and as we talked about at the outset, it's easier, it's cheaper to get it from somebody you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, boy, I think of many, many, many years ago, and it was always illegal, right? Mm-hmm. And you always had that person that you went to
yeah.
who you trusted. Yeah. And it was whatever, relatively inexpensive. And now it's just prohibitively priced.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're a cannabis consumer in California, you've been getting your cannabis a certain way for a long time, and you might be getting it from a trusted source. This could be an individual, this could be a caregiver, this could be a dispensary. And essentially, when recreational cannabis was implemented in California under Proposition 64, a lot of that access disappeared because unlicensed dispensaries began to experience a crackdown from the state government, right?
Right.
So if you are a person who's been getting your cannabis from a certain place a certain way for a long time, you're not necessarily going to pay a 25% sales tax just for the pleasure of going into a store to buy your cannabis, especially if the variety of cannabis available in that store is much more limited than what you were getting before. Moreover, there's counties in California where dispensaries are not allowed at all, but those counties still, of course, have medical cannabis patients in them. So for those patients to go on Weedmaps and not be able to find any dispensaries, well, they're definitely going to turn to the black market because there's nowhere else for them to go. So the state really wants to shrink the black market and allow this so-called quote-unquote white market to thrive. But at the same time, they're ignoring the needs of the very consumers who they want to be shopping at those licensed dispensaries. A lot of times when somebody thinks of an unlicensed cannabis dealer, they think of a drug dealer or something like that. But in a lot of cases, this is a person who's cultivating cannabis and distributing it to people and has been doing that for a long time for the good of themselves or for the good of those patients. And that person who was cultivating and distributing cannabis before Prop 64 without a license, they're more likely to have a criminal record and thereby way less likely to actually have a license under Prop 64. But if you're a customer of that cannabis provider, you're more likely to stick to what you know than you are to start paying a lot more money for something different.
And going to like a MedMen or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Abdullah Saeed, a cannabis journalist, the host of the podcast, Great Moments in Weed History. Abdullah, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for us. Next week, DACA meets SCOTUS. Next on KCRW, it's Storytime with the Bookworm. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, PJ Shahamat, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Christine Camito, Amy Ta, and Christian Bordahl all make this show happen. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great day.